couple months ago, I got in trouble by my grandma because every time she's able to make it in the afternoon, I'm not leading the singing or I'm not preaching. So I purposely schedule myself to be in the afternoon and someone's not feeling good. I think I've got the hint. So, if you will, turn your Bibles to Job chapter 1. We're going to be spending a lot of our time in Job this morning. Or this afternoon. Whatever it is. I'm still in lunch hour here. As you're turning there to Job, I want to start off asking you, have you ever felt that the whole world is against you at times? Do you feel that your closest friends, maybe family, maybe everyone that's around you, work, school, whoever it might be, just you get that feeling that everyone is against you? You get the feeling that you cannot say the right things, you cannot do the right things. No matter what is going on, you can't do it right. And you even get the feeling that you, those around you seem like, to you at least, that you're the worst person on the planet. You cannot do anything right. You feel alone in the world and that no one is there for you. I know I've been there at times, and I would say most of us here can say the same thing. We've had things that's happened in our lives where we've had these feelings. And we need to understand that these feelings are real. And if we do not overcome these feelings, it will drive us away from our friends. It'll drive us away from our family. But it'll also drive us away from God, the only one that truly can help. Today we're going to look at a few individuals in the Bible, primarily Job, that went through the same feelings, or by the Scriptures we can grasp the idea that they probably had this feeling as well, and feeling alone. We're primarily going to look at the life of Job and spend most of our time connecting with him. And then we're also going to be looking at briefly at Noah. We're also going to go to the New Testament and look at the adulterous woman who Jesus forgave when all others were ready to stone her. So I'd like to start off reading. We're going to be reading the first chapter, actually, of Job. Job 1 through 22. It says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of all them. For Job said, 'It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hand, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Seabans fell upon them and took them, and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another one said, the Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Verse 22, in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. What do we learn about Job in just this first chapter? I know there's a lot more things we can learn from him, but I mean, we want to start off looking at, we can see that he lived in the land of Uz, which was likely the land of Edom, just southeast of the Dead Sea. But he was a man of remarkable character. He was blessed by a large family. It mentioned he had seven sons and three daughters. He had many possessions. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and it says very many servants. We learn this just by the few verses that we start off this chapter. And we can see at the end of verse 3, it talks about Job, meaning everything about him was the greatest of all men of the East. He was thought of God to be blameless and upright. He feared God. He gave reverence to God, and he shunned evil. He was a remarkable man. He was someone we should pattern ourselves after. And again, we read in verse 8 that there was none like him on the earth. But now as the account continues, we now see Satan enter the picture like we see Satan so many times come. And he accuses Job of only being the man that God described because of the blessings that he had given him, that God had given him. Basically saying that if God would have not taken away every blessing, if God would have taken every blessing from Job, that Job would definitely curse God. He says, does Job not fear God for anything? Satan is trying to prove that man will do right only when it benefits man, and that God is not worthy of service on the basis of his nature alone. And in response, God puts all that Job has in Satan's power, with the exception of Job himself, taking his life. He says he was not to harm Job. God is simply going to prove that there are people with a true devotion to God Almighty for who he was and who he is, and not only for what they can get out of it. And as the account read, in one day, Job lost all his material possessions through various calamities. We kept hearing the messenger coming, talking about how horrible of calamities there were. It even talks about his sons and his daughters were also killed with a great wind, destroying the house on top of them. So you could just put yourself in the shoes of Job and imagine the grief he was going through. What all could have been going through his mind? He was grieving, but we also read that Job worshiped God and does not charge God with wrong. He mourns, he tears his robe, he shaves his head, falls to the ground. Even though he knows and considers that God was the one who had done all these things, we read that he blesses the name of the Lord and worships him. When we would move into chapter 2, we find that Satan appears before God again. The Lord asks him if Job had remained faithful despite his losses. Of course, this, you know, when he hears what Job did and how he responded, it only gets to Satan even more, and he claims that the test had not been severe enough. Satan says in verse 5 of chapter 2, touch his bones and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. So God then allowed Satan power over Job once again. But only to the point of actually taking his life. So with this power, we would read, if we read the context here and through the chapter, that Satan strikes Job with a terrible disease. The disease is described as having boils, itchy, runny, sores, corroding bones, gnawing pain, and blackened skin. He would have drastically changed in appearance, as well as a constant fever. And all this continued, not just for the day, not for weeks, but for months, it says. Just the pain and the agony he would have been going through. At this point, I think each of us here would be feeling that condition of loneliness and that abandonment that we discussed earlier in the beginning of the lesson. We would feel that we were all alone and that the world is against us. Now I want us to pause right here and consider, how would we react to the stuff happening to us? I'm not trying to minimize the things that we go through. And I know there are many things that we suffer in life. But when we think about as a country, we get this feeling of abandonment, this loneliness, over some of the simplest things when you look at the scheme of life. We're ready to take drastic measures when we maybe lose friendships in life, when we don't get the job we felt we deserved, when we can't have things in life like the car we wanted, the house that we wanted, that we had our hopes up for. The things that we suffer do not measure up at all to what Job went through. You know, there's many lessons we can learn from Job just by this alone. Now, all this happened. Lost all his material things. Lost his family. He's going through this great suffering of sickness. But at least he still had his wife. That should have been there to comfort him, right? And as we would hope that our closest companions would do for us, especially going through these trials. But that's not the case for Job either. This companion that he had to rely on as support for each other as they battled through their losses together has now turned against him, only adding to Job's loneliness and feeling that he has no one around him. But I'd like to look at chapter 2 and verse 10. It says, "But he said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?' In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." He understood that life was made up of great things. I mean, we know that he was one of the greatest of the area in the land. But great things doesn't mean that he will not receive trials in life, will not receive evil. So Job's response to his wife further illustrates his faith in God. A faith in God that we need to have as well. And we need to learn again from Job. Well, now, as we know, the story continues. Job now has three friends that come to visit and try to bring comfort. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar that come to mourn with him, try to comfort him. However, they are shocked when they see Job. The scriptures define that they had a hard time even recognizing him because of the disease and the boils that he had. And they sit dumbfounded for seven days and nights without even a word in reaction to the magnitude of Job's grief. We later learn that these friends turned to him and give advice to him that was not helpful to the cause and not helpful to Job's faithfulness to God, the faithfulness that had led him so far in his life. I don't necessarily want to get too much more in the depth of the life of Job, but I wanted to share the first two chapters to help us understand the suffering of Job in comparison to our lives. And we learn from Job how to suffer, how we need to suffer. We need to make sure that we understand that no matter how much we suffer, we are not alone. We have God there always with us, ready and willing to help. If you will turn to in Job and chapter 42, the last chapter in Job. I'd like to read just a few verses here before we move on. Job 42 and verses 10 through 12. And it says, "And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and ate bread with him in his house. And they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. And he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys." Something I want us to consider, when we look at the life of Job here, and we look at all the things that he suffered and his faithfulness through all of these things, it's comforting to know, and we read here in verses 12, that the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than the beginning. Now, I know when we look at the life of Job here and what it's describing here is that physical blessing and all that, but what we need to understand is when we live our life faithfully to God and we don't give in to those temptations and we suffer the way we need to like Job, we will be blessed later than we have in the beginning through our hope in heaven. His life was blessed because of what and how he suffered, and we need to learn how to suffer today. Moving on from Job, I want to share quickly the thoughts concerning Noah. Noah, as we know, went through so much in his life, but when we look primarily at the time he was building the ark, we can imagine that he too felt that the world was against him. He would have been mocked because he was preparing for a flood that many around him thought would never happen. Noah was given instructions from God to save his family while he destroyed the corruptness of the earth. Noah and his family were the only ones that feared God and were alone when it came to their faith. But as we know, God was there for Noah just as he was for Job. And he saved his family. And he blessed Noah's family through his promises for generations. Now, quickly looking over at the New Testament, if you will turn to John 8. We'll be reading the first 8 verses here, and we're going to be looking, as I mentioned, how Jesus forgives the adulterous woman. John 8, starting in verse 1. They went to each own house, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law of Moses commanded us to stone such a woman, so what do you say?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his fingers on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older one, and Jesus left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on sin no more." Here we can see described for us as a woman that was caught in a sinful act, and we don't want to dismiss that situation as well, but we can see she truly was caught more in the middle of a situation, and that's why she was brought to light for her sin. The scribes and Pharisees, we can see, were not interested in the law and bringing her to justice, but rather their focus was trying to catch Jesus in breaking the law of Moses. Here she is standing against the people with everyone against her. And they're ready to stone her to death, even though they, when you look at the context, you look at the law, they weren't even carrying out the law themselves. Even though she feared her death and was probably considering her choices she had made, there's Jesus giving her life. Life that she was not expecting. Jesus tells the woman that he is there for her, and he can and he will forgive her. But he warns her, as we read, to learn from her mistakes and sin no more. There are many other examples we can look at, but I think we can learn from these three examples and get the message we're trying to get through tonight. We need to understand and we need to learn that when we feel alone and we feel that the world is against us, Jesus is there. We need to understand that God is faithful and he will bless you more than the beginning if we trust in him. One last passage I want to look at, if you'll turn to Matthew 14 and verse 28. I want to end the lesson looking in Matthew 14. This is a passage here where Peter walks on the water with Jesus, and it's something that actually Heath had used as an illustration many years ago, and it's one that's kind of stuck with me. Matthew 14, verses 28-33. Says, "And Peter answered him, 'Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water.' He said, 'Come.' So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, 'Lord, save me.' Jesus immediately reached out to his hand and took a hold of him, saying to him, 'O you of little faith, why do you doubt?' And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, 'Truly, you are the Son of God.'" We see here again that Peter calls for Jesus to call him out on the water to where he can be walking on the water. And Jesus calls for him to come out. And so Jesus and Peter are both on the water walking. But Peter becomes afraid. And he starts to sink. And the key verse there is what changed is in verse 30. It says, "When he saw the wind." It's something for years I've kind of looked over and read over and didn't really give it much thought. But as Heath illustrated, when he saw the wind, that means that he did something, didn't he? He took his eyes off of Jesus. He started looking at everything physically around him and what physically should be happening if he's out in the middle of the water. He should be sinking, right? But Jesus was there. Jesus was the one that was his strength through there. But when he saw the wind and started sinking, Jesus says, "Oh, you of little faith." We can read passage after passage of those who put their trust in Jesus. And each one became victorious in their situations they faced. You will always have Jesus on your side and helping you through any situations if we let ourselves and we keep our eyes on him. We need to understand that we are not alone. And we will never be alone if we put Jesus first in our lives. If you're not a Christian this afternoon and you have the feeling of loneliness and you feel that the world is against you, then you need to realize that God is calling. He is calling, he is waiting, but the action is on our part. We must take that first step. You need to realize that your soul is lost and you need to take steps to be his child. You need to believe that he is who he says he is. You need to be willing to change your life from the sinful life you are living, confess his name before others, and in order to be saved, you must be buried in water and wash away your sins. If you have been baptized this afternoon, but like Peter, you have taken your eyes off of Jesus, then we ask that you refocus your life to him and put your faith and trust back in him and know that you're never alone. If there's anything that we can do to assist you today, please make it known as together we stand and sing the invitation song.